This is Sex Science Saturday here on the Jeff Booth Show, brought to you by the Center for Sexual Expression and Education and Erotic University. I've been following the situation for a while. The problem with pediatricians not offering or explaining or promoting the HPV vaccine to their patients. But I did something in my reading that I haven't done before. I went to a medical website, which only allows comments by doctors, to kind of get an idea of what's being said. And that was pretty disturbing. You think doctors are going to be very educated. You think that they're going to be reasonable and rational. But unfortunately, doctors are pretty much like everybody else. For example, here's part of a comment from a Dr. Deborah Proctor. She writes, "If this vaccine is a method of birth control cloaked in preventative medicine outfit, then it's failing. HPV vaccination has nothing at all to do with birth control." This is a doctor making a profoundly ignorant comment. Here's a comment from Ronald Morehouse. "I do not know any provider that is embarrassed to discuss sexual activity with patients and parents." Well, my wife has encountered doctors who were, and it's pretty well documented that there are plenty of doctors who have problems with discussing sexual issues, and it's pretty well documented that doctors are not well trained in sexual issues. Then there's another doctor who comments that, yeah, he thinks the vaccine is a good idea, but not at 11 years of age, and that is too early to deal with anything that has to do with sex and children. This despite the fact that you need to vaccinate people before they become sexually active. There were comments like, well, cervical cancer is rare, it's no big deal, it's just a moneymaker for the pharmaceutical companies. Well, the truth is that cervical cancer is the fourth most common cancer in women. Now, it's impossible to determine how widespread these ignorant ideas are amongst doctors, but clearly, while we don't know the specific concepts that these doctors are taking up, we do know that there is a huge problem, and it's pretty depressing reading comments from medical professionals that are this ignorant. In a survey by the makers of Trojan products and the Sex Information and Education Council of Canada, 2,400 Canadians between 40 and 59 were asked to talk about their sexual habits. According to Dr. Robin Milhausen, who is the researcher at the University of Guelph, there is a public perception that as we age, sex becomes less important, less enjoyable, and less frequent. The study findings indicate that most midlife Canadians are indeed leading satisfying and active sexual lives. And more than that, they're actually leading a very adventurous sex life, according to this survey. And this certainly goes along with my experience. You don't see people really until their 30s or 40s really start to sexually experiment a lot. That's when a lot of people start swinging. That's when they start exploring BDSM. That's when they start exploring sex toys. Milhausen continues, "Sexual and relationship satisfaction were highly interrelated, and the most emotionally satisfied in the relationships reported the highest level of pleasure. And married people are reporting sex as pleasurable as their single counterparts. In fact, married men reported more satisfaction from their recent sexual encounters than single men did. The survey also found that people reported that it was communication, adequate foreplay, and post-sex affection as things which made their sex more enjoyable and satisfying." So, good news, Miley Cyrus. I know you think sex ends at 30, but actually the good news is that it just goes on and on and on and actually gets better over time. Now, here's a study. It's called the Sexual Identity, Mobility, and Depressive Symptoms, a longitudinal analysis of moderating factors among sexual minority women. And it comes from the work of several researchers. It seems primarily the Department of Sociology at the University of Utah, but also the Department of Psychological Sciences in Texas and the Department of Health System Science at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science, University of North Dakota, and the Survey Research Laboratory at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And their findings were pretty surprising. One of the findings was that 25% of their sample changed their sexual identity every 5 to 6 years. Their findings come from an analysis of the Chicago Health and Life Experiences of Women study, which came in three different waves of data. Now remember, they're looking at women who are already self-defined as being in a sexual minority. And they found that when women shifted their sexual identity to lesbian or bi, depressive symptoms went up. And we've already got quite a bit of data that shows that lesbian women suffer depression more than heterosexual women. But interestingly enough, there's tons of data that bisexual women suffer depression even more than either lesbian or heterosexual women. Now, obviously, you don't become depressed because you're bisexual. You're not depressed because you're lesbian. Those problems are caused by societal attitudes about these things. And we really, as yet, don't completely understand all of the factors that are involved with this. But clearly, there's something going on there. It's not particularly good. And clearly, more research needs to be done. There's an interesting study in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology this month. They looked at the well-known trend that sexual desire tends to subside gradually over time, and couples often have a difficulty maintaining desire in their long-term relationships. So there were three studies that employed complementary methodologies, and they were combined together to examine whether partner responsiveness and intimacy-building behavior could instill desire for one's partner. So in the first study, participants were led to believe that they could interact online with their partner. In reality, they interacted with either a responsive or an unresponsive confederate. In the second study, participants interacted face-to-face with their partner, and judges coded their displays of responsiveness and sexual desire. And then in the third one, they used a daily experiences methodology to examine the mechanisms underlying the responsiveness-desire linkage. Combining all of that together, what they found was that feeling special and being perceived as having a lot of value as a partner had a direct correlation with how much desire was maintained in the relationship. You probably heard the saying, familiarity breeds contempt. Well, it's long been thought by researchers that long-term intimacy can actually inhibit rather than increase sexual desire. But what this shows is that it really is how much a partner values you and cares for you that is more determinant. And while this effect is more powerful on women, it also impacts men as well.